Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
We, of course, are likely to see ethanol consumption rates going down as consumers, United States consumes less gasoline. We're already seeing that in the data now as we electrified to our auto fleet to some degree.
Speaking recently at the American Seed Trade Association meeting in Chicago, Dan Bossi, president of Ag Resource Company.
That being said, the pivot, if you will, is going to be taking that ethanol and producing sustainable aviation fuel. If the United States were to produce, let's say, 17 or 18% of the jet fuel that's produced in this country, we would consume all of the ethanol which is currently produced today. So there is demand for ethanol, if you will, or that other biofuel going forward. Sustainable aviation fuel is it because, as we said, nobody wants to fly in battery-operated planes.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Well, you know, the last couple of years, we've seen rather bullish agricultural markets. Inflation has soared. We've seen a tremendous amount of money coming into the ag markets, which has lifted corn prices up to $7, soybeans up to $15. And we've sat at these prices for quite a while now.
Dan Bossi is president of Ag Resource Management in Chicago.
The year ahead doesn't look quite as pleasing. The U.S. is losing export competitiveness overseas. We look like we're going to have favorable weather in Brazil. And as we look at the demand profile, because of the rising dollar and rising interest rates, slowing economy globally is not going to be very good for grain demand. So unfortunately, 2023 looks to be kind of a downer year, if you will, for grain markets. Again, assuming normal weather and that God is kind to farmers around the world.
What about margins? Do farmers still have positive margins?
The farmer does have margin. As we look at corn and soybean profitability ratios for the upcoming growing season, they look quite good if the farmer were to lock in the prices of today. That said, I think they're also a little bit concerned that maybe we've reached what we call peak farmland, in which there's no additional acres. So if you're in the seed business wanting to expand, you really have to steal market share from someone else. And so that's a little bit of a different world than where we've been in. But we've got this arable landmass. Unless USDA is willing to pull acres out of the CRP program, I think that we're sitting with about 270 or 267 million total crop acres in this country. Seed people will see that as enough, but not that expansion they'd really like to think about in their futures.
But moving into 2023, how important will capital be?
Well, I think as you think about 23 and 24, everyone needs to prepare to have more capital. I think capital is going to be the key to success in the years ahead. As you visit your bankers and talk about operational loans or whatever you're dealing with, make sure you have enough of that. Because I think with the volatility that will be ahead, that having capital will be the key to expansion and the ability for you to, or for any company to look at their neighbors and excel, relatively speaking. So it's about capital, even though the cost is higher. I think it's a key thing to have in the future.
So let's focus on renewables for a moment. Are they here for the long run?
Yeah, renewables are what we call green fuels, if we can lob them into that basket, have been very important to the Biden administration. They've grown, and in fact, as we think about forthcoming, Biden sees this as a stepping stone to electrification. It's going to take a while before we move from fossil fuels to a electrified auto fleet or truck fleet. And before that, because of low carbon and the ability of using green fuels, he sees that as the opportunity to go forward. So we'll follow along with that. It's good for U.S. agriculture. It's a demand driver, but it's also a very bumpy road in terms of getting there, because as we bring plants online, as we look at crush facilities, as all the infrastructure that's needed, the markets will, of course, go up and down and back and forth in many ways because of the pending change and the opportunity forthcoming.
A stepping stone.
Yeah, it's a stepping stone. I mean, if we look at renewables and in terms of U.S. and global agricultural production, we're talking about less than like 7%. So it is, we in agriculture through green fuels cannot solve the world's or the U.S.'s energy problems. They're just too massive and too demonstrative for us to do that. We can be a help, as you're seeing ethanol blended at 10% of some of the gasoline supply, 15% in other areas. But as you think forward, you know, renewable diesel is a hydrocracker process that gives us that uses reclaimed vegetable oils, lard, tallow, and soybean oil or vegetable oils, and gives us a product, diesel, that's just like conventional fossil fuel diesel. So these are an enlightening some excitement because it is lower carbon, and states like California, Oregon, and Washington see great promise in that lower carbon fuel.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The amazing thing about the American Seed Trade Association is we were founded over 135 years ago in 1883 on the basis of developing quality germplasm for America's farmers.
Andy Levine, President and CEO, American Seed Trade Association.
That still is our ultimate goal as we bring products to the American farmers and homeowners and land managers. It's across the board. That quality seed is important for produce growers, for flower growers, for turf grass managers, just all across the board. And we look at it, especially as we talked about this opportunity and conservation in that arena, it's important when farmers are making decisions about cover crops as well.
Talks about a resource they have.
We realize that that's a challenge as farmers look to make sure that they are meeting the goals that they have for their conservation efforts on their farm and their operations. We wanted to make sure that they knew where to buy that professionally produced regional seed. And we created a landing page on the ASTA website, which is betterseed.org. And on that site, we've got a map, and farmers can go on in their regions, the seven regions of the country, including Mexico and Canada, as a matter of fact, so actually nine regions, where people can go on and see where professionally produced seed is available and the companies that are producing that seed. These aren't names that farmers may be familiar with, so we wanted to make sure that there was a quick, easy place that people can go to and get, obviously, advice on different blends and varieties that they may be looking for cover crops, but also ensuring that they're getting that professionally produced. That company is going to stand behind it, and those seed companies are doing a great job to meet the demand that the farmers have as these programs continue to evolve.
And with the farm bill debate here,
there are similar priorities as we've had in the past and some new ones. I always look at our first number one priority is agricultural research. That's just the bedrock of the seed industry. It is how we bring new varieties into the marketplace. That public-private relationship that we have with our land grant institutions and USDA's research programs that they've got under the REE undersecretary are just vital for us. And so that's our number one core as we look at it. We've got to push strong, vibrant, resource-funded agricultural research, and that comes from the Farm Bill, a lot of that direction. You know, we've got conservation programs that are going to continue to be key, and the cover crop sustainability discussion, I think, will fall under that area in this Farm Bill. I don't think this is going to go away, or we don't think this is going to go away in discussions with the House and Senate and the administration and the public. We want to help the farmers as much as possible on the sustainability front and encouraging them to do and providing them the resources to do what they can on their operations. And then looking at plant breeding innovations, it does fall in that ag research area, but dealing with the policy of it, how can we make sure that all crops have the ability to use innovation in plant breeding and genetics and discovery, and use it in a way that continues to evolve, not restricts that capacity. We don't need a new breeding method like gene editing to only be available to breeders in corn, soybeans, and cotton. It needs to be available in produce, in tree crops, in vine crops, in cover crops, forage crops, others across the board, so that farmers can take advantage of innovation no matter what crop they grow in their operations. So those are probably our core ones. Continue to strongly support the agriculture community and the various associations and their priorities, because ultimately they're our partners that we bring new products to. And so we need to make sure that they've got good, strong programs that follow them as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The Association of Equipment Manufacturers, really for the last 30-plus years, have each month we release the tractor and combine report, where we kind of track the classes of sales of tractors and combines. And it gives a pretty good barometer of the overall ag economy, sort of some attitudes out there in the field.
Kurt Blades is Senior Vice President of Ag at the Association of Equipment Manufacturers.
Well, so AEM, kind of in our mission for the last few years, we've been releasing really good kind of industry position papers that really kind of the gift to the entire ag industry to help spur some conversation. And building on that tradition, during the pandemic, we started putting together a group of about 20 different executives and and futurists within our member companies and representing agriculture. We tried to build out some scenarios of what the future is going to look like in the next, frankly, in the next 10 to 15 years, not looking out very far, and created some scenarios that really are going to help AEM to, you know, drive its services, but also to help inform our members as they look into markets that they want to serve to best make sure that we are responding to the needs that the customers have out there. And, you know, the third benefit of that is that we make this available to the public for, you know, just to spur those conversations, whether it's with a policymaker or just the general public. People love to talk about the future. And when you can put tangible pieces of information out there of where food is going to come from or what's happening on the innovation space within agriculture, it's a really fun conversation that allows us to move from what has historically been a defensive posture when we move to policymakers saying, hey, we're on the offense, we're doing some really fun things. Come join us and make it easier for us to feed the world in a more sustainable way.
And he also explains the 13 pieces of this new study.
The 13 pieces all sort of work together really to solve what I would consider to be our biggest challenges facing society. And it's not just facing agriculture, facing society. First among those being workforce challenges. We all know that finding good help in agriculture is a little bit difficult. So one of the trends really addresses that. A second trend is talking about the convergence of innovation and how innovation, you know, whether it's artificial intelligence or wireless connectivity or battery technology or go through the list, it's all coming together at the same time in a really unique manner that allows us to do things that we would have never dreamed of doing before. And then the final thing is, you know, what we've talked about a little bit is, you know, the need to address sustainability concerns or the bigger societal concerns. So all 13 of these trends really focus in on solving those three challenges. And whether it is, you know, trend number one, which is produce more with less environmental impact, or number two, optimize for water use. And you can't open up a newspaper today or turn on the television without hearing concerns about water or concerns about environmental impact. So, you know, knowing that we as an industry in agriculture and we specifically as equipment manufacturers are taking that to heart, that matters a lot when having a conversation with the policymaker. That matters a lot when having a conversation with the EPA. They can trust that we are on the problem and we're going to solve it with innovation.
And this is Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Mexico and AMLO and biotech has been an issue that has been near and dear to him since day one.
Greg Dowd is the former chief ag negotiator for the U.S. Trade Representative.
He's made it very clear that, particularly with regard to corn, he's not a big fan of it. There have been some approvals of biotech trades down in Mexico, but nothing really related to corn or major commodities that I'm aware of, at least anyway. Maybe there have been, but I'm not aware of anything significant. So the first point is that Mexico, you know, this is, other than China, this is our biggest corn market for U.S. corn exports, yellow corn. And they're not going to approve biotech trades. They're not going to get commercialized because there's no way to keep all of that separate and send one thing to Mexico and something else to the rest of the world. So this is really inhibiting our ability to improve our technology in the biotech space in corn. Part of the Mexican issue is, well, they, you know, it's white corn to them for human consumption is what they grow. We do export some white corn to them that is biotech. And I think this is where a lot of the sensitivity is. But the answer to the question is, I really don't know whether early next year, when his self-imposed deadline for all of this in terms of stopping the potential imports of U.S. corn is going to happen or not, it would certainly not be in Mexico's best interest for that to happen. We'll just have to see it. And I think certainly my former colleagues are highly engaged in this, and this administration is engaged in this at the highest levels. And this is an important topic on the trade policy side early in the new year, without question.
President of Mexico's López Obrador, or as he's commonly referred to, AMLO.
This is one of those things where AMLO is dug in. And so we're going to have to really bear down with Mexico and work through this. And it's going to be a very high priority topic between the U.S. and Mexico in agriculture. And as the Mexico deadline that they've imposed approaches here, this is going to get serious.
What's ahead in 23?
I think it's going to be a challenge for us in certain parts of the world where per capita incomes are kind of below that middle income threshold. And then you combine that with the fact that I think Brazil is just going to be absolutely busting the bins down there here as we get into the middle of next year. We need some water in the Mississippi River somewhere along the way as well here. So I think the combination of these factors just means that 2022, we're probably going to have another record in terms of U.S. ag exports, but 2023 is we're going to have some very, very serious headwinds, both in terms of demand destruction in the world, supplies from competitors, and the strength and the value of the dollar.
And infrastructure concerns?
The issue is we have two options. We can go to the West Coast and go through Portland. We still, my understanding is you get out into December, January, there's still a little room there for some elevations in the corn and soybean areas. But it's just cost prohibitive right now to move a barge of grain down the Mississippi and be competitive in the world marketplace. And that's unfortunate because our window on soybeans is really the middle of September through the middle of February. And so my point is, if we can't get this stuff down the Mississippi by the middle of February and get it loaded on a boat, we're going to miss our window. The Brazilians are going to take over, and there are going to be some really disappointing trade numbers here by the time we get to the middle of next year. There's no question about it.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There are issues that, in, at least in my state, we've been through several farm bills that I've actually now been involved with four. The one we're heading into would be my fifth, going back to our days in the House of Representatives. And I keep a very close relationship with our agricultural groups in South Dakota.
That's South Dakota's Senator John Thune, a member of the Senate Ag Committee.
And on this particular legislation, the Cattle Transparency Markets Bill, my constituency is very divided. I have groups that are for it. I have groups that are against it. And I like to listen to all my groups. It'd be nice if there was a position where there was more unity. We've had people testify in front of this committee. Justin Tupper, who runs the St. Ange Sale Barn in South Dakota, did a great job of explaining some of the issues related to cattle pricing these days. And he's a supporter of this bill. I give his great weight to his opinions on these issues. But we also have organizations in my state that are strongly, and I say strongly, opposed to this bill. The one thing that generally unites them, I would say with one exception in South Dakota, is their support for mandatory country of origin labeling. And I think the reason for that is very simple. We label everything in this country. The tie that you're wearing, all the clothes that you're wearing, my belt, everything we wear, everything we buy in this country is labeled, except the thing that we put in the center of our plate, beef and pork. We label poultry. We label lamb. We label fish. We don't label beef and pork. And I think we have tried this before, and we've run into resistance from the World Trade Organization. And so this was repealed over my objections back in 2016 in an appropriation bill. But we worked hard in two previous farm bills to get country of origin labeling included. Now, since it was repealed in 2016, a lot has happened. We passed USMCA. The two objectors to country of origin labeling at the World Trade Organization were Canada and Mexico. And the World Trade Organization found that there were technical barriers related to segregating and record keeping around that. Well, since then, we've passed a trade agreement that is very beneficial to both of those countries. We have a lot of new technology these days that should eliminate some of the record-keeping and segregation issues that always seem to get in the way of this. And Senator Tester and I, who introduced this bill, designed it so that USTR and the Department of Agriculture could write the bill in a way that is WTO compliant. In the past, it's been us, Congress, who has written the meat labeling bill. And when it got voted down at the WTO, there was a movement here to try and repeal it, which happened. But I would argue that if we're going to do this in the right way, let's give the USTR, the United States Trade Representative's Office, and USDA an opportunity to collaborate. And our bill allows them 1 year to do that, 1 year to work in a way that would create a labeling regime in this country that would survive a challenge at the World Trade Organization that they would be willing to go and fight for at the World Trade Organization. I just get tired of kowtowing to the World Trade Organization. It's just insane to me that we don't have the very thing that we put in the center of our plate labeled when everything else that comes into this country has to be labeled.
South Dakota Senator John Thune, it's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Last year, we submitted an amendment to our clearing order, which would allow us to operate as almost every other clearinghouse does, with margin. We have spent tens of thousands of hours talking with the commission about this proposal and thousands of pages of documents.
From a House Ag Committee hearing earlier this year, Sam Bankman-Fried, founder and CEO of FTX.
We really, really deeply respect the thorough process that the CFTC has undergone, the amount of time that they have spent digging into the details of our proposal, challenging it where appropriate, and the seriousness with which they are treating this this proposal. We respect the CFTC and their process and whatever conclusions they ultimately come to. I will note that while our proposal does combine things together in a way that I think might bring powerful innovation to this space, each of the elements already exists in CFTC-licensed derivatives exchanges, including ICE NGX, LedgerX, and others. I believe that the amendment that we put forward would help promote healthy markets. I think that would promote fair and equitable access to platforms. In particular, traditional exchanges charge for market data such that only the largest traders are able to get full knowledge of the markets that they are supposed to be trading on. With FTX, all of our market data is 100% free, transparent, and public. All users, regulators, and other observers have full access to our market data. Traditional exchanges have separate models for the largest traders and for other users such that only the largest traders have direct access with lower latency fees and more options. We would have equitable access to our platform where all users can choose the method of access that they most prefer and have access to the most powerful tools. We also have strong customer protections under our model. It is a safe and conservative risk model, which would have helped to alleviate some of the instances that we've seen with recent future exchanges, like the LME Nickel fiasco earlier this year, by having the collateral pre-funded at the clearinghouse rather than relying on credit, and having a real-time risk engine. We also have enhanced customer protections. We have all of the customer protections that exist on traditional futures exchanges and on FCMs because we understand deeply that we have a responsibility to ensure that if there is direct access to the platform, that users are still afforded the same level of protection. On top of that, we have further customer protections, suitability, and transparency than what you find on most other platforms. Finally, we believe that this would bring competition and innovation. It would bring liquidity to the U.S. marketplace and options to U.S. consumers. It would bring competition in the futures market, where almost all of the volume is traded by just two exchanges. And it would bring competitiveness to the United States with respect to the rest of the world. Today, 95% of digital asset volume trades overseas. And that brings me to some of the broader context here. Digital asset marketplaces need federal oversight. They need that oversight to protect consumers, to protect against systemic risk, to bring liquidity back onshore, to ensure U.S. competitiveness globally. This is good for the U.S. economy, for Americans, for wealth creation, and good for our consumers. The CFTC is an appropriate regulator to provide this for digital asset futures contracts. They have been doing so on CME and other platforms for a number of years. They're a thorough regulator who understands this space very deeply.
Interesting to hear it 7 months later from Sam Bankman-Fried, founder and former CEO of bankrupt FTX. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The final USDA-led agricultural trade mission of this year recently concluded, with Spain and Portugal the focal point of this latest effort. And while formal announcements have yet to be made regarding 2023 USDA-led ag trade missions, Foreign Agricultural Service Associate Administrator Clay Hamilton gave indication which nations and regions might be under consideration.
Right now, we're looking at Panama, Japan, and The Hague over the next 4 or 5 months. We'll probably have 3 more after that.
Hamilton says FAS sets a goal of 6 ag trade missions per year, with the schedule during any 1 year a mix between well-established, developing, and potentially new markets.
We feel like they're very important. There's a great return on the investment, and we'll take our cues from the companies that participate as to which countries they feel are the most important.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.